economic divide.
Hello, welcome to Economic Divide. I'm Kavit Atley. In today's program, we're going to take a look at crypto world, in particular, Bitcoin. Why are central banks so worried about cryptocurrency as a whole? Some of the highlights of today's program, what is Bitcoin? We're going to define that for you. What is cryptocurrency? What is blockchain? And you hear about mining, what is that? What actually determines the worth of cryptocurrency? And what is the big deal anyways? Is it worth the investment? Also, we'll also take a look at governments in particular and their central banks. They want you to believe that everything is cool, that they're still under control. But are they scrambling to play catch-up, or are they trying to see how they can maybe control it, or maybe they're just looking for ways to undermine it, like the U.S. Fed or the European Central Bank? Then we're going to take a look at crypto enlisting, like Coinbase. It got listed on NASDAQ. Also, Bitcoin got listed a few years back, not the coin itself, but then they're dangerous because the Dow took a correction. So, pretty much a risky bet, wouldn't you say? Elon Musk, Tesla creator, entrepreneur, and billionaire, dancing. But Bitcoin crash, is he dancing about that? Well, he had some killer tweets that led to the crash. However, he then focused on Dogecoin. Is that his new bet now?
Cryptocurrencies took a big hit recently. A massive crash in cryptocurrency prices wiped out $1 trillion of wealth. Bitcoin, the biggest and most popular cryptocurrency, plunged 50% to its lowest level since January, hitting a low of nearly $30,000. Meanwhile, other popular digital currencies tanked as well. Ether and Dogecoin both declined by 25 to 30% as well. The swing in the cryptocurrency market came after China reportedly banned banks from cryptocurrency business. The U.S. also announced a crackdown by the Department of Justice and the IRS, expressing concerns that cryptocurrencies are being used to conceal illegal transactions.
We will not allow digital asset service providers to operate in the shadows and will not tolerate the use of the cryptocurrencies in support of illicit activities.
One sign that cryptocurrencies are giving real money a run for the money, so to speak, is that they are actually being listed in the stock markets. Now take the listing of San Francisco-based Coinbase. Coinbase became one of the biggest U.S. cryptocurrency exchanges. The owner recalls his early days.
Yes, it's scary because it's new and there are new security concerns that need to be addressed with it, but that's sort of where I see Coinbase coming in. It's the sort of consumer-friendly front.
So Coinbase is the NASDAQ for cryptocurrencies. And what you have to think about is, you know, there's tons of cryptocurrencies. And the question is, like, how do you trade against that? And that's what Coinbase does. And they did a lot of business. They did $1.8 billion worth in Q1 alone.
They have almost 56 million users, only 4 million of them active, monthly activities. So 4 million, about 7% of them, they are really making these kind of activities on the exchange. 56%. Of the trades of the $335 billion is done with two types of cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin and Ethereum.
Now you hear Bitcoin there. Well, Bitcoin also made its debut on a major stock exchange back in the year 2017. Well, the coin itself did not make its debut. It was introduced as a futures contract. A futures contract is a financial product that allows investors to bet on whether the currency's price will rise or fall. Now, at that time, Bitcoin opened at $15,000 per unit at the Chicago Board Options Exchange.
So we here at Cboe view cryptocurrencies as a new asset class, and as such, we think that it's ready for derivatives, and that's why we've chosen to list futures on Bitcoin. We think that it brings some needed regulation to the Bitcoin marketplace, and it gives people who have concerns around custody of Bitcoin or the process of opening wallets gives them access to Bitcoin in a more traditional form.
Okay, it's time to ask a fundamental question here. That question is, what is the purpose of digital currency? That is a simple enough question, isn't it? Well, let's go to China to find out the answer to that question. Here is the BOAO Forum for Asia in Hainan Province, China. They brought together a host of professionals, figures like Zhu Jiuquan, ex-governor of China's central bank.
各个国家还有各个国家的需求，现在呢，我们可以做长远的设想，说未来全球这个货币可能啊，会有像一体化呀，也没有那么多复杂的汇率问题，向这个方向去发展可以，但是现在来讲，还不行。
In this segment, we have a Q&A with Miguel Francis Santiago. He's the founder and CEO of the Future Is Now Media Group. Miguel, welcome to the program. We are looking at the notion of cryptocurrencies and digital money, which is still foreign to some, just like the beginning days of internet. So if you can please explain the technology to us, how it operates, especially when it comes, its, I guess, comparison when it's being made to real money.
Well, it operates by creating an alternative store of value and also a store of transactions where you do not have to resort to a centralized banking system to help you get that done, either to store your value, your money, or to transact with your value, your money. By having a decentralized ledger technology as the underlying building block of it, composed of many nodes all over the world, to enable the system to work. That is why it takes time for the hash to go through the system and for the money to transact, and that is why sometimes when the system is overloaded, although we are in the inception ages, I mean, we're literally taking baby steps right now, even though Bitcoin has, you know, surpassed the all-time high of 20K, and we saw the all-time high of 63K this year, as compared to its previous bull run in 2018, we're still in baby steps.
Okay, thank you so much for that. We do appreciate it, Miguel. All right, we're headed for a quick break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere. We have plenty more coming up. Stay right where you are. But before we go for the break, here's one family that has taken the crypto craze to a whole new level. They abandoned the traditional way of life, whether it's work or their kids' schooling, to live a crypto lifestyle.
Yeah, we live solely on Bitcoin as much as possible, and we try to live on places in places where, like, the Bitcoin is accepted a little bit more. So, like, where there is a restaurant and a hotel that accept Bitcoin, it's more easy for us.
We don't need to go to school, and we don't need to stand up at 8 o'clock in the morning.
It's time for an in-depth section. Let's take a look at Bitcoin when it started out. Essentially, when it did, it was in the year 2009, and it was worth 0.008 cents of a dollar. Imagine that. And then it went to 8 cents per dollar, which shot up 900%. Then in February of 2011, it hit parity with the dollar, which meant that it was worth $1, and has not looked back since. It peaked at $19,783 in December of 2017. Now, the current price, as of May 29, it stands at roughly around, you're going to see that in a second, $36,000, May of 2021. And it has been extremely volatile after the crash. There was a crash. Take a look at the price when it hit the high. It was $61,783. Now, just think if you had purchased one back when it was just 8 cents or even less, just imagine how much profits you would have made. Well, now comes the functioning part of cryptocurrencies, how they work. By now, you might have read up on it, but here are the facts for those who either don't understand it or are just plain in the dark about it. Okay. As we know, Bitcoin is an online currency. As I've mentioned, it's created from computer codes, and it has been in circulation since 2009. The identity of its creator remains a mystery. It has no connection to a central bank and is not backed by any government. Instead, its community of users control and regulate it via what's called the blockchain. Basically, it's a mathematical process to provide anonymous and secure transfers.
So Bitcoin is a decentralized cryptocurrency. It's purely internet-based. That's part of the appeal to a lot of people because it's decentralized. It's not controlled by any central government. And it can be traded, you know, across currencies in the same way that that fiat currencies can.
Okay, to get started, you create what's called a Bitcoin. You have to actually create that. It generates an address, which is unique to each transaction, which can then be used to buy goods and services or other currencies. As each transaction then becomes validated by members of the community, and that's done by tracing the origin of each Bitcoin using special software. This is what's called mining. But to make sure that no single Bitcoin can be spent in more than one place simultaneously, which is one of the most important things about Bitcoin and currencies, digital currencies. Now, the fastest to do so are issued with new Bitcoins, and as a result, they're rewarded for their efforts. Now, let's move on to the question here. Does Bitcoin use too much energy? Well, mining requires enormous processing power. I mean, you wouldn't believe how much power it takes. You have powerful computers who are consuming huge amounts of electricity, some as much as a country. It is estimated that in 2021, Bitcoin's annual consumption could actually climb to 128 terawatt hours, that is. That's 0.6% of world electricity production, or 10 times more than Google, if you can believe that. Now, there are giant data centers or huge mining factories. In terms of their location, you're looking at China, 65% of them, 6.9% in Russia, and then in the U.S., 7.2%. Now, critics like China and even Tesla's Elon Musk point to the environmental impact that the electricity generates through mining regions, which contributes to things like climate change. Well, let's bring in Keith Pilbeam for this segment. He's a professor of international economics and finance at City University in London. Maybe he can shed more light on this topic. Keith, welcome. When we take a look at Bitcoin in terms of what it does, digital currencies as a whole, Bitcoin to be one of them, it is said that it's the future. It's the way that perhaps dollar is going to be replaced, and of course it's going to be used for transactions, but the key appeal being that central governments, and in particular central banks, don't control them. What are your thoughts on that, and do you agree with the future of Bitcoin in terms of its efficiency?
Well, I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding here. Bitcoin is not going to become a global currency, all right, in the same way that the US dollar. There's no chance of that happening. The US authorities, of course, central banks, may produce their own digital currencies that are counterparts to their national currencies. But as I say, Bitcoin can be traded amongst those that want to trade it, but most people don't accept it.
All right, Keith there and his take on Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. Our next focus, billionaire Elon Musk. You either love him or hate him, depending on whether he was a reason for you to make money or lose money, as was the case with some of his tweets, which caused crypto mayhem and a crypto crash.
He may be a bit odd. Quirky, perhaps. But make no mistake, he's a genius by some standards for his accomplishments. After all, you don't become the world's richest man worth billions of dollars by accident. And he must wield some power if one tweet can send the price of a crypto coin skyrocket or crash, as was the case with Bitcoin. This is the tweet that sent the price of Bitcoin crashing. He also then said that cryptocurrencies cannot come as a cost to the environment.
Musk has been one of the cheerleaders, the biggest proponents of Bitcoin, and for 3 months later, for him to start to cite environmental issues, which have not changed in the last 3 months, it's something where this U-turn is definitely not being taken well by investors in the crypto market.
His car company Tesla revealed in February it had bought $1.5 billion worth of Bitcoin. The company later said it had trimmed its position by 10% in the first quarter. Now, his love affair is with Dogecoin. He called Dogecoin the people's crypto. But a market that can sink based on a person's tweet? This is a classic case of extreme volatility, which prevents cryptocurrency growth while detracting investors.
Elon had a very short affair with Bitcoin. I guess he didn't realize who he married. You know, I know that Tesla stands for green cars and electric cars and so on, but those cars consume exactly the same electricity that Bitcoin consumes. So I think it was a premature divorce.
Maybe it's better that he pay attention to his own recommendation, which he tweeted here.
Hello, welcome to the Info News section. Now, the first item that we want to take a look at, which caught our attention from this past week, was from right here in Iran. In terms of what has happened, well, in regards to energy, Iran has banned crypto mining. Now, you may ask, obviously, why Iran decided to do that. Well, unfortunately, what has happened is that because of crypto mining, you've had electricity outages and shortages that happened not only in the capital, but around the country. That's how much energy crypto mining actually uses. And in terms of the world, 4.5% of all Bitcoin mining takes place in Iran, 4.5%. So that gives you an idea as to how much crypto mining occurs right here in the Islamic Republic. Next up, Total demo. Not a total demo, Total, as in the oil or petroleum company. It's been accused of ecocide, human rights violations, and also greenwashing. Why? Well, fossil fuel projects in Uganda is the reason. It has actually affected 178 villages there in Uganda. So again, you have an oil company that's being accused of things like you know, climate change or factors that affect or contribute to climate change. This particular item is very interesting. Declining population is something that needs to be looked at. Fewer babies cries, more abandoned homes, and deaths exceed births. That's actually taken from a headline on this. Basically, we're looking at a declining population because countries are confronting what's called population stagnation and a fertility bust. So you're having a decrease in population, which could lead to complication in a wide variety of arenas. This may be a topic for our future program. And finally, enough of capitalism. Yeah, we've heard that before, but obviously it's very hard to follow. Why? Endless economic growth is not good. Now, why would that not be good? The reasons are many, as you're about to see over here. Extraction, production, and consumption, that can be harmful. It can affect the environment. You have plastic bags that carry shopping bags that carry goods, etc. These all affect the human life in one way or another. So those were some of the top stories. We always like to hear from you. If you want to contribute to a topic to the program, do send it to us to our email address, the old-fashioned way. We'd love to hear from you. Now, decentralization is one thing. Evading central government's banking system so that they can't control how we spend our money. But when an entire country is placed under sanctions, especially a central bank, that is a totally different story. Countries under heavy U.S. sanctions have taken matters into their own hands, the crypto way. Okay, let me bring back Keith Pilbeam for this segment. Keith, many sanction-hit countries like Venezuela, Russia, and of course Iran, they have welcomed the use of cryptocurrencies in order to evade the illegal U.S. sanctions. China has developed its own digital yuan. Are we looking at the dollar being replaced at some point due to the rise of these cryptocurrencies?
There's no danger of the U.S. dollar being replaced by digital currencies. There will be a digital dollar, I've got no doubt about that, over time, and that will complement the existing dollar. As there will be eventually, you know, a digital euro and probably a digital pound. But these will just be equivalent to the national currencies. And there needs to be very careful monitoring and mechanisms. But they will be widely accepted as a use of payment, okay? Now, lots of people are thinking that these coins are going to replace currencies. They're not. They may complement. Some people will have good use and they can be used. But don't forget, over time, it's getting easier to transfer money at very low rates, and it's not so cheap. If you want to transfer money in Bitcoin, there are various fees, and there's an awful lot of risk, all right? A lot of people don't realize that at any moment, if you don't hold your money in a what they call a cold wallet, and it's held on an exchange, your account could be blocked. The exchange might just block it. So people have to be very careful in the way they're managing these their money.
Let's find out what Miguel Francis Santiago thinks, the founder and CEO of the Future Is Now Media Group. Miguel, welcome back. Do do you agree with what Keith said in terms of the crypto and the dollar? I mean, first of all, when it comes to the countries like Venezuela, Russia, and Iran, they're replacing or they're going with crypto, and they've welcomed it in order to evade the illegal U.S. sanctions. But will cryptocurrencies overall lead eventually to the replacement of the dollar from transactions, do you think?
Well, we're getting the U.S. digital dollar. I mean, we are going to see the dollar replaced, but it's not going to be replaced in the modern sense. It's by anything better than what is already there. If a centralized government authority is giving me a monetary system of exchange that's based on the blockchain, I'm not going to take that. I feel that that is absolutely, it's ludicrous to think that this is even, it has nothing to do with cryptocurrencies. I mean, these are centralized tools of control being perpetuated by central governments like digital dollar, digital yuan, and sure, they will, digital euro, they will probably replace the reserve paper dollar, but the whole point in that is only because the, the status quo is getting rid of paper money. That's the only reason that that's happening, because all of a sudden you can now have this whole la-la land fabricated bubble system of government bonds on, instead of on paper, on a digital blockchain trackable ledger. And that is not good for the masses. That is not good for the people. If anything, that's very good for a COVID passport and potentially using that technology to be stored on your COVID passport, if it may be a digital card or a digital chip, whatever. Then that supposedly will, you know, be sold to you as a way to cut through the layer of governments, to cut through the bureaucracy under the guise of innovation. But in reality, that's you giving up your freedom ultimately to a government blockchain.
From Russia to Venezuela to China and to Iran, cryptocurrencies have an appeal. The main reason? To evade U.S. sanctions.
My sense of cryptocurrencies largely driven to evade U.S. sanctions and to undermine sovereign currencies. Both of them are a challenge to the national interests of the United States.
We need to search for unconventional solutions. These are the people who will build our new future and live there.
Let's not forget, they are illegal, hence the appeal. Each country uses it to get around the sanctions. But there is another hope behind using the cryptocurrencies, to replace the U.S. dollar as the common currency. China has adopted its own digital currency called the digital yuan. It is already being used on a wide scale. Only time will tell whether that can eliminate the dollar along with other digital currencies.
Digital currencies like Bitcoin or Dogecoin or many others, they are here to stay. There is no doubt about that. You've heard our guests. Now, whether that is a good thing or not, well, that is the question. Let's look at this from another angle. For example, pretend if you were a Syrian or an Iraqi and your country was getting bombed. Obviously, you wouldn't like that. Well, central governments control the money supply, money to wage wars. That is a fact. Hence, the appeal of cryptocurrencies. Now, the downside, there are laws that citizens are breaking, like ones who are kidnapping or drug lords, for example, or tax evaders. They love cryptocurrencies. Did I say tax evaders? Well, consider this. Tax evasion remains a problem to this day, and countries committing the most tax evasions, the ones holding the biggest central banks, they're the ones, like in the U.S. and in the U.K., for example. Well, all that I have said really is nothing new. But what will be new is when crypto usage becomes so mainstream that it leaves central governments without the power that they once had, the power that controlled our lives one way or another. And that could affect their decision in terms of policies, which requires capital from foreign policy to you name it. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. Your questions and comments are always welcome. It was a pleasure to have you. Until next time, I'm Kavit Atlee. It's goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Mark Dullard, founder and chairman of Kids Rights, said, apart from patients of the coronavirus, children have been hardest hit, not directly by the virus itself, but fundamentally felt through the deferred actions of governments around the world. We prepared for you an article written by staff writers of Agence France-Presse News Agency under the heading Watchdog says children risk generational catastrophe from COVID. Rights group said in an annual survey recently that the coronavirus pandemic has severely affected children's rights worldwide, with young people risking a generational catastrophe if governments do not act. Dutch non-governmental organization Kids Rights said, as it launched its annual ranking, millions of children have missed out on education because of COVID-19 restrictions, while there will be a long-term impact in terms of their physical and mental health. The survey ranks Iceland, Switzerland, and Finland as best for children's rights, and Chad, Afghanistan, and Sierra Leone as the worst out of a total of 182 countries. Mark Dullard, founder and chairman of Kids Rights, said that the effects of the pandemic on children had unfortunately exceeded our predictions at the outset last year. He said, apart from patients of the coronavirus, children have been hardest hit, not directly by the virus itself, but fundamentally felt through the deferred actions of governments around the world. Mark Dullard added, educational recovery is the key to avoiding generational catastrophe. The group said schools for more than 168 million children have been closed for almost a full year, with one in three children worldwide unable to access remote learning while their schools were shut down. And
additional 142 million kids fell into material poverty as the global economy was hit by the coronavirus pandemic, while 370 million kids missed out on school meals. Kids' Rights hailed Bangladesh for taking over a national television channel for homeschooling and praised Belgium and Sweden for trying to keep schools open. Meanwhile, 80 million children under the age of one could miss out on routine vaccination for other diseases because of disruption to healthcare systems. The report said there was also an astonishing increase in domestic violence during lockdowns, with children often ending up as the victims. Kids' Rights included Palestine on its list for the first time, placing it in 104th position due to a focus on healthcare despite difficult circumstances. However, as in previous years, it gave low scores to Britain, Australia, and New Zealand due to a lack of legal protection for children relative to their wealth. Britain and New Zealand were ranked at 169 and 168, respectively, below North Korea, below Syria, Iraq, and Sudan, and just ahead of Eritrea. Austria and Hungary also fell heavily due to discrimination. The survey uses United Nations data to measure how countries measure up to the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. Millions of people are losing their lives with no access to vaccines in poor countries, while rich countries are sitting on large caches of surplus vaccines and refusing to share them. The dire situation has prompted a call by several leading organizations for world leaders to make a new commitment to a more equal distribution of coronavirus vaccines. In a letter published on the Washington Post recently, the heads of the World Health Organization, WHO, World Bank, International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Trade Organization, WTO, said, "Bringing the pandemic to an end requires global action now." They said, "It has become abundantly clear that there will be no broad-based recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic without an end to the health crisis," adding, "Access to vaccination is key to both." The joint opinion editorial called on the group of seven wealthy nations, the G7, to agree on a stepped-up coordinated strategy backed by new financing to vaccinate the world. The leaders of the G7 are due to hold a summit in the United Kingdom later on this month. The joint letter recommended that the G7 agree to fund a $50 billion plan already put forward by the International Monetary Fund to accelerate the end of the coronavirus pandemic. The G7 leaders met in central London recently and committed to financially support United Nations-backed program COVAX, but there was no immediate announcement of fresh funding or improved access to vaccines. Back in March of this year, the World Health Organization warned against vaccine inequality, which it described as grotesque, calling on vaccine-wealthy nations to refrain from giving shots to children and adolescents and instead donate those vaccine doses to other nations. The World Health Organization said only 14 of the 21 countries in the Eastern Mediterranean region, which extends from Morocco to Afghanistan, have received inoculations, equivalent to little more than 1% of the population of the entire region. In the meantime, the United States has purchased 200 million more vaccines for its own citizens, pushing poorer countries and vulnerable populations to the back of the queue. Foreign leaders have repeatedly called on U.S. President Joe Biden to provide help on accessing coronavirus vaccines. However, the president said his administration would help the rest of the world only after all American citizens have access to the vaccine. Though experts estimate that low-income countries will experience wide access after 2022, they warn that delaying inoculations will allow the virus opportunity to mutate, potentially undermining available vaccines and ultimately a global recovery. Recently, South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa described the situation as tantamount to vaccine apartheid. Cyril Ramaphosa said, "The populations of advanced rich countries are safely inoculated, while millions of people in poorer countries die in the queue." According to the World Health Organization, the Sub-Saharan Africa has administered the fewest vaccines relative to its population of any region, with roughly 8 doses per 1,000 people versus 150 doses per 1,000 people globally. According to data collected by Johns Hopkins University, the pandemic has so far claimed the lives of 3.55 million people worldwide and infected over 170 million people across the world.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on June 4, 2014, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of the demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine.
Islamic awakening, in which anti-arrogant feelings were dominant more than any other phenomenon. In Islamic countries and our region is a sign of this curiosity and search for the truth, and it continues to exist. It is possible that Western and American intelligence services report to their seniors that they have managed to suppress Islamic awakening in our region. If they have such a notion, then this will be another strategic mistake and another wrong interpretation on the part of our enemies. Islamic awakening might be suppressed for a while in part of the world of Islam, but it will undoubtedly not be uprooted. On the contrary, it will develop. This understanding, this perception, and this awareness in all countries and among Muslim youth in the region is not something that can be destroyed easily. Of course, they will make certain efforts in order to destroy it, and these efforts may seem to be successful in some areas in the short run, but in the end, they will prove to be fruitless. Curiosity that exists in today's young generation all over the world, particularly in the world of Islam, about the phenomenon of religious democracy is rooted in the fact that the Islamic Republic is a phenomenon from whose birth 35 years have passed. And during all these 35 years, it has faced the violent and hostile reactions of the dominant powers in the world. They showed military reactions, they showed propaganda reactions, they showed economic reactions, which began from the beginning of the revolution and which have been reinforced on a daily basis, and they showed political reactions. It is 35 years now that this powerful Western camp has been doing whatever it could against the Islamic Republic. It has made military efforts. It has helped the aggressors who attacked our country. It has supported the enemies of the Islamic Republic in any area. It has used widespread propaganda, and it has made perfect and unprecedented efforts in the area of sanctions and economic siege.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Protests for racial justice were wide-reaching. People from all walks of life in Britain, especially young people who took to the streets, were demanding racial justice. Not only concerned about anti-black racism in the United States, but also about deep and evident systemic racism in the United Kingdom. We now present you an article written by Richard Sudan. Richard Sudan is a journalist, writer, and television reporter. The piece is titled, New UK Police Powers Aiming to Shut Down Black Lives Matter Protests Must Be Stopped. Police crime sentencing and courts bill is on its way to becoming law, making its passage through the UK Parliament before passing through the House of Lords. In the latest move by the government to clamp down on a number of issues, including what they claim is unlawful disruption. However, the move, which aims to give the police more power to carry out their duties, has actually produced more of the very thing which critics claim is the whole reason the bill came into being in the first place, which is, of course, the very legitimate and critical right to protest. In 2020, mass demonstrations took place around the country from both Black Lives Matter supporters, galvanized by the mass global movements for justice following the murder of George Floyd in the United States, and also environmental activists raising alarm over the growing climate emergency. The protests for racial justice were wide-reaching. People from all walks of life in Britain, especially young people who took to the streets, were demanding racial justice, not only concerned about anti-black racism in the United States of America, but also about deep and evident systemic racism in the United Kingdom. Environmental protesters and demonstrations also swept across the country, with some in London causing disruption to public transport in order to get their message across and to get their voices heard. And getting the message to the forefront of public debate is precisely the point of the protests. While the British government has focused on the toppling of statues and of the inconvenience to those using London trains to get to work to justify more police power, the reality is that should the police bill become law, it will likely be exploited to shut down very legitimate and lawful protests, with critics alarmed that the authorities will have the legal means to shut down and stifle any real criticism of the government at all. The problems of racial inequality, injustice, and of corruption and incompetence within the UK government, in many people's eyes, far outweigh and are of far greater concern than protesters stepping beyond the bounds of so-called legality. The right to protest in the United Kingdom is something purportedly sacred and is often talked about as being an essential cornerstone of Britain's so-called democracy. And yes, sometimes protests can get heated. But remember too that there are often serious questions about the conduct of the police, who many would argue themselves operate outside of the law, while at times being accused of breaking the law while operating with complete impunity. There has to be a balance, and listening to the concerns of legal experts and those with a keen eye on the importance of civil liberties, it isn't hard to see why there are serious concerns about the UK police having more powers. Many argue that the UK police need to correctly manage the existing powers which they already have and not be given more powers, which, as well as giving the police the power to keep people off the streets indefinitely, will also arguably impact and devastate the lives of Britain's traveller communities. Traveller communities have a way of life which is thousands of years old, and there are serious worries that the new police bill will be used in order to legally control their freedom of movement and to do the opposite of facilitating their way of life. Such communities are part of Britain's multicultural society and should have the same rights as everyone else and should not be treated as a nuisance to be pushed to the margins as the authorities see fit. The truth is that the British government was terrified by the collectivized message and power of protest movement last year, and in particular of the effectiveness of the Black Lives Matter movement, and the ability of such demonstrations to galvanize and inspire people to challenge power and the status quo. Also worth remembering is that a Metropolitan Police officer was charged with the murder of Sarah Everard. Some argue that there are serious problems within the police themselves, institutionally, which need rooting out, because they're given any more authority to adjudicate over the right of the public to mobilize, even if at times protests might become disruptive and hard for them to manage. When apartheid in South Africa was brought to an end, it was because mass global protests took place demanding it, and without such global protests, much needed change would have been jeopardized. Huge protests also just took place in London, demanding an end to apartheid in Palestine, with some even arguing that there were the biggest show of solidarity in the streets for the Palestinians which have ever taken place in Britain. This is something to be celebrated. But according to a new report, British media coverage of the recent Israeli aggression against the Gaza Strip was biased against Palestinians and skewed public impressions. The Muslim Council of Britain's Centre for Media Monitoring analysed the British media coverage of the conflict in a 44-page report entitled Media Reporting on Palestine 2021. The Muslim Council of Britain's Centre for Media Monitoring stated that during the 11-day war, there were 62,400 online print articles and 7,997 television broadcasts in the United Kingdom reporting on the incidents. The report has revealed that while there were some examples of balanced coverage, the overall narrative was unbalanced due to the skewed language, misleading headlines, and problematic framing. Rizwana Hamid, director of the Muslim Council of Britain's Centre for Media Monitoring and co-author of the report, told the Middle East Eye that the overwhelming amount of complaints about British media's biased coverage of events in Palestine aligned with the analysis and evidence of the monitoring organization. The report found that half of the broadcast media clips in the United Kingdom between 7th and 10th of May referred to the situation in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of the city of Al-Quds as an eviction or real estate dispute, which justifies the forced displacements of Palestinians, while the Israeli action were in contravention of international laws. Regarding Israeli police brutality against Palestinian protesters and worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, the investigation highlighted numerous examples of media sources utilizing terminology such as clashes, conflict, scuffles, and skirmishes to suggest equal blame. Rizwana Hamid said, as far as language is concerned, terms such as evictions mask the illegal forced removals and expulsion of Palestinians from their homes, adding that references to conflict and clashes try to equalize what is in effect a battle between David and Goliath. The Muslim Council of Britain's Centre for Media Monitoring also cited several news reports speaking of an intifada, which is said played into fear-mongering and framing Palestinians as violent aggressors. Thus, more protests calling to kill the bill regarding the proposed police powers have also been taking place, and they will continue. It's abundantly clear that the British people do not want this bill to become law and value their right to protest and to speak truth to power as sacred. Rather than ploughing ahead with its current plans, for once this current government should listen to the demands of what seems to be the vast majority of the British people. In fact, people's demand to protest and assemble is a fundamental right of any free society and is the essence of free speech. The British government seeking the power to shut this down wherever they see fit is draconian and is the opposite of what people expect from a decent democracy.
Around the World with Reporters.
After days of campaigning for the upcoming presidential vote in Iran, candidates now stand toe-to-toe for a face-off. On Saturday, the seven runners attended the first televised debate, which was aired live on national television. Themed with economy, the first debate required the candidates to answer common questions, ranging from monetary policies to domestic production and boosting exports.
In order to boost domestic production, we need to reduce the taxes levied on our producers and in return increase the taxes on unproductive businesses such as real estate or forex trading.
8 years ago in the same place, I showed you a 10,000 rial banknote and warned you that if the current trend went on, our national currency would collapse. We need to take a different approach than using people's pockets to solve the government's problems.
We have prepared a package that consists of 213 projects. 51 of them are focused on harnessing inflation and controlling the prices.
When we speak about eliminating poverty, we're not just talking about basic rights, but it's also about entertainment and health policies. I have a comprehensive plan that can tackle these issues.
We need to turn our focus toward a 500 million strong market that exists in the region and not our 80 million strong domestic market. I mean, we need to strengthen our regional diplomacy and open up to the world to attract investment.
The debate started with random questions to each of the candidates, but got raucous after Abdel Nasser Hemati picked on the other contenders, saying they're running to promote poverty rather than wealth.
Unlike the other candidates, I don't like to resort to lying to attract more votes. None of them is speaking of the distribution of wealth, but increasing poverty. I will pay equal attention to both creating wealth and its fair distribution.
Hemati's comment was not left unanswered, as Alireza Zakani lashed out at him by reminding him of his poor performance as the head of the Central Bank of Iran, blaming him for the unprecedented devaluation of the national currency, the rial, which is currently traded at 240,000 against the U.S. dollar.
You have dealt an irreparable blow to the national currency, yet you accuse us of spreading poverty. You have already increased poverty during your tenure, while I speak of national production and boosting it. So please stop making accusations.
There are still two debates to go. The second and third debates will take place on Tuesday and Saturday, respectively, which will investigate the candidates' cultural and political policies. While the debate offers an opportunity for each of the candidates to try to stand out and make the best impression to voters, it also gives a chance to the public to weigh up all the choices in one go. Yet, it's still too soon to judge about who stands a better chance to win the race, since the rivalry is still on. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Yemen Nasrallah movement dismissed as baseless an accusation by the U.S., which mentioned the movement as the main cause behind the war in Yemen. Earlier, the U.S. State Department issued a statement accusing the Nasrallah movement of prolonging the conflict and worsening Yemen's humanitarian crisis by attacking Marib, the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces in northern Yemen.
التصريح الخارجية
The accusation of the US State Department against